Radio Vermont, WDEV, takes no responsibility for the opinions or statements made by the House Calls Vermont show host or their guests. The information provided during the House Calls Vermont show is offered only as a public service and should not be used as a substitute for obtaining any professional advice from a licensed professional.
Our house.
WDEV presents House Calls Vermont with hosts Jim Bradley and Chris West. Each week, a new topic specific to building or renovating in the Green Mountains and your phone calls. Brought to you by RK Miles, a third-generation family-owned business. Proud to be your local building material supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years known for anything construction. Big or small jobs, one call does it all. P-O-L-L-I Construction.com. Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor. 802-793-2002. By Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. By Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing. Shamrockpainting.com. By Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, for all things basement-y, northernnefoundations.com. Your participation today is encouraged. Call the listener line with questions at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Now, House Calls Vermont with Jim and Chris.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Chris West with my buddy Jim Bradley.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon.
And we are back here in the studio. I seem to have a bit of a weird sound, but we'll just run with it. This week, we're going to be talking about zero-energy houses. And one of the things that we've known in the last 20 years is one of the goals for a house is to be off the grid. This goes back to the autarkic house or the off-the-grid house from the 1970s, people trying to reduce their, you know, carbon footprint, trying not to take energy from the grid. And we have often had long debates about what it is that net zero energy means. And there have been different definitions. So today we're going to be digging into that. We're going to be talking about what is net zero energy, what percentage of the energy that we use as a nation is actually used for different parts of our country, commercial, industrial, transportation, housing. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. If we're trying to reduce our overall emissions, carbon dioxide emissions and other emissions, then we need to know what we're going to be doing with our houses, how what kind of an effect that will have on the overall picture. I just want to repeat that number, 802-244-1777. I never say the toll-free number because I think it was 1992 the last time I used a toll-free number. But if you really wanted to use the toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255. There was a moment where phone companies just said there is no charge to call from New York to California any different than there is to call from New York to New York. So at that point, you know, I'm not waiting until 2 in the morning to call my friend in California for a cheaper rate. but Jim, let's just chat a little about this whole zero energy story.
Sure, you know, and we're looking, especially now, people are, as they see fuel prices rising and everything else, they're trying to see, okay, what is the best way to invest their monies, especially new construction and retrofits. And so how can I decrease that outgo of my finances and get it to where it's more manageable? Well, some of the things with this type of building, this net zero energy building, that type of building or passive house or even the deep energy retrofits on an existing structure, up front, it has a price tag, of course.
Yep.
But a lot of these, like even passive house construction, construction. If you invest roughly around 15% more than your normal build, you're going to come out cash flow positive day one because your utilities are reduced so extensively of what it's going to cost to operate that home on a regular basis if you mortgage your house for 30 years. And so it's going to be a positive there. And yet that's hard to wrap our heads around that sometime because we don't usually look at the cost of utilities when we're purchasing or building a new home. But
called overall the cost of ownership, right?
Yes, exactly.
What it costs to run a building month to month.
Yeah, and you know, and so some people say, okay, well, isn't just net zero energy buildings or net zero building, isn't that just another buzzword or whatever? Well, think about it. If we can create a home that is going to be very efficient, very comfortable, and it can actually produce its own energy, so everything is produced on site and you're not sending that money elsewhere. Isn't that a great and attractive thing to think about? You know, some people think, well, that's just like the old passive solar back in the day in the 70s and everything else. No, it's actually, it's gaining steam and momentum around the world. And many jurisdictions are actually now requiring this type of building. So we have to figure out how we get there. And what is so true with so many types of building methods, the first one or two that you do, you're saying, what was I thinking? Why would I ever do this? But then after that first two, and you start getting some momentum behind you, and you understand the processes of how to do this right, you're thinking, why wasn't I doing this all along? So there's a learning curve.
Absolutely.
And now the materials that we can source, where before, when you wanted to be the first one out there, I remember one of the
getting
first,
a triple glazed window,
or you know, 6 inches of insulation on the outside of your wall, like Chris did at his house.
2012.
Yeah, 2012. But back in the day, there weren't even screws long enough, so people were using spikes like nails to fasten it on there with. But you know, technology is increasing and catching up so quickly that these are attainable and they're much more cost effective. The big thing about this is when we build intelligently like this, and we're looking at our investment, it's not just about how much we're going to save in the energy out of our pocketbooks by what we would spend on site for heating, cooling, operation of the building. It's also that replacement cost. And the replacement cost, because our building materials should, if they're properly appointed and properly installed, they're going to last so much longer. So you're not going to be repainting your house as soon or replacing that siding within 10 years where it should have lasted over 50 years.
Or 100 years if it's done right.
Exactly.
So one of the things that we brought up at the very beginning of the show is if we're looking at what our input is to global warming, right? To carbon dioxide addition and sulfur dioxide and the nitrogen oxides that are part of burning processes. What is housing on top of all that? And there's a source that Jim has looked up, the Monthly Energy Review from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, a part of the Department of Energy. And what they saw as they broke down energy per sector is that industry is about 33% of all the energy that we use, 18% mm-hmm. for commercial, and about 26% for transportation, leaving 22% for residential. I've seen those numbers slightly different. The 2030 architecture mm-hmm. had one that showed our built environment, kind of mixing the commercial and the residential into one at about 40%. So it tracks here.
Sure.
So if we were able to reduce our residential energy use by 20%,
sure,
that would end up being 20% of 22, which is about 5% of the total energy use for the country, right? If we could reduce that, you know, 20% for each of our houses, which is basically what weatherization gets us. A good mm-hmm. weatherization job
definitely
is 20%. Now, a deep energy retrofit or a passive house, that's getting you down to like 80% reduction.
Sure.
And then you're if you're doing an 80% reduction, that's 22%, you're getting up around, you know, 18-17% of the energy output of the country. And that is something that we can all look at when we're building new. For certainly building new is better. It's less expensive to put all of these things into place.
Definitely.
During a new build. We were at an energy audit not that long ago where it really looked like the best thing for this owner to do would be to take all the to take all the siding off, air seal with a membrane, put rigid insulation on the outside,
new windows,
yep, the whole thing. And that's a huge investment.
Definitely.
But from our observations, neither of those homeowners had spent a lot of time doing maintenance over time.
Exactly.
So what is it you say about deferred maintenance?
Well, just that's what it is. It's maintenance deferred. So you're not properly maintaining your house. You're deferring maintenance until some other day. But in the meantime, what's happening as your siding starts to crack and open up, water chases behind the walls, and then it starts rotting out the structure, destroying the insulation. And so it's a crescendo effect. It just gets worse and worse. And so maintaining things, don't defer the maintenance. Take care of it in a timely manner.
And the basic rule of thumb is if you were to build a house, that house that you're living in right now, with that super insulation, with that super air sealing, with that indoor air quality, ERV, and all the other things that we've talked about over the years, you have a certain price. If you're to build that house and then need to retrofit that house, those would be 30% more in cost, right? Because all the labor to remove, all the new materials, what I'm basically saying is if you have an opportunity, if you're out there, you know someone who's building a new house or you're building a new house, it's the time to reach out to us or to someone like us and say, I would really like to have a house that is super insulated and super energy efficient. Yes, it'll cost me 15% more, up front, but my out-of-pocket expenses are going to be a wash. I'll be net positive as far as my expenditures from that moment because my utilities will be so much lower.
And the big thing, too, is when standard code-compliant construction, even with good intentions, because of the type of materials, because of what's allowed to be put into a structure at this current point in time, is one where it is usually going to start failing very quickly. And so why would I want to spend out of my pocket quickly the funds that I use to buy this beautiful new house, beautiful new kitchen with
most expensive thing you'll ever
exactly.
buy.
And then all of a sudden someone tells me in a very short amount of time, you've got mold behind the scenes. You've got water damage because of infiltration from bulk water moisture, or you've got other condensation issues. And you just don't want to hear that type of thing. So why not build it right up front or retrofit it appropriately, not just put a Band-Aid on something.
Yep.
And so your house will be more like that drum thumping pink bunny that just keeps on going and going and going, the Energizer bunny. So it'll last here from today into the generations to come.
So the first, when we're talking about net zero energy, basically the old joke was you can build a really bad house.
A barn.
and put a lot of PV up and you can be net zero.
Exactly.
However, we're trying to be a little more careful with our resources.
Yes.
So the right thing to do is to build the house or reduce the existing house's load first. It's like when someone says to us, Chris, I'd love to start using heat pumps. I'd love to get rid of my forced hot air or radiant floor or radiant, boiler.
Yes.
But not every house is ready for that.
No.
Heat pumps are great. The downside to heat pumps is that it uses at least air to air or heat pumps is that they use air to transport heat. And air just has a much lower heat capacity than water or another fluid, which is what we usually use for moving heat around in your radiators, right? Whereas you have baseboard radiators or something like that. So if you're going to go from using a system that has either uses a fluid as a fluid for moving around the heat, or you're going to change from a forced hot air system, which has a very high temperature air and a very high flow rate to get the same amount of heat into your house, and you want to go to heat pumps, you've got to be very careful that you're going to be able to heat your house and keep it comfortable with those heat pumps. And that means, super airtight. It means insulated walls. It means looking at the infiltration. It means possibly putting in a heat recovery ventilation system before you go ahead and spend money on heat pumps.
Well, the one thing that is very important to that is there was a lady that I spoke with years ago at a conference and from Vermont, and she was lauding over the fact that she had put in this new geothermal, heat pump system in her house. And I asked her, I said, well, those don't usually work really well in Vermont all year because there's a point in time of diminishing return and it can't usually make up enough heat to heat the building appropriately, so it'll switch over to a less electric resistance heating. And I said, did you factor that in when you spent $40,000 plus on this system? And this, of course, was probably about 10 years ago, actually. And she said, well, yeah, I did. So that's why I got a PV system or a solar array, and that was another $30,000. And she says, that'll create the backup. I said, have you had an energy
audit
done yet on your home? Because it was an older home. She goes, what's that? And so start first. I mean, granted, we're just trying to be honest brokers here about this. I mean, it's sometimes really neat and sexy to have that PV array, that solar array, and you're saying, look, I'm creating energy on site. That's good. But if you're going to be selecting where you're going to invest your resources first, yep, it's get the structure to use less energy first. Get that conservation going, because once you can do that, then it makes so much more sense to put the resources back towards these other items. Because I always tell people, you know, you could choose a heat source that's going to be really, really efficient. And then if your building's really leaky, then you're really effectively heating outdoors efficiently, not right. The indoors.
Right. So when we're talking about – they're just noticing we're right up against our first break. We'll be back after the break. Once again, in between, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 and tell us about your DIY project or ask questions about the topic today, and we'll see you after the break.
Christmas Eve Then and Now by Wythe Windows. Christmas Eve then.
And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
Tighten up that kerchief. It's going to be a cold one.
It's that nasty draft from the window that's to blame.
Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash.
Hurry, I think I see something.
It's stuck.
And Christmas Eve now.
Look, it's Santa. What a clear, unobstructed view we get through our Wythe windows. Quick, tilt it open.
Hey, Santa, it's Jim.
Those are some good-looking Wythe tilt-and-turn windows.
I know. 8 locking points keep them air and watertight, and they're made in New Jersey.
That's my next stop. I have a new guitar for the boss.
I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight.
Wythe windows for all, for a house cozy and tight.
Wythe windows, high-performance passive house windows and doors. Online at WYTHEWindows.com.
Good afternoon. You're back here with us at House Calls Vermont, and I'm Jim Bradley, along with my colleague and friend, Chris West. There we go. Welcome back today. And with that, we are talking about net zero energy buildings, or basically a net zero home, and what it takes to get there, whether it's an existing structure that you're doing a deep energy retrofit with, or it's going to be a brand new structure. But basically, in a nutshell, what is the definition of net zero energy?
Yeah. So, unfortunately, there are a couple, but the best.
Who are we talking to today?
Right. Exactly. The best one is that you are producing all the energy that you need to run all of the services of the house, not just your heating and cooling, but all of your plug loads, your computers, your refrigerators, mm-hmm. everything on site, or that you've got a community solar somewhere that's
exactly.
doing it. So that you are not importing energy from somewhere else. Now, there are some interesting ones, like, is it net zero if you're bucking your own wood,
mm-hmm.
right? That's out in there.
Creating
your own pellets, yep. or buying pellets from the local sawmill.
I mean,
there's a sawmill here in Essex nearby that has looked into turning their sawdust into pellets. Where are we actually drawing the line on what net zero means? So I would consider something that someone who is bucking their own wood and doing all of their own heating with that wood to be considered net zero, because it's all happening on site.
Sure.
Now, I don't use a lot of wood for heating. My house, I usually use it when the power's out.
Or ambiance.
The ambiance. but in general, when I retrofit my house in 2012, I went all electric. I got rid of my oil tanks, got rid of my oil boiler, got rid of all the baseboard radiators, and went 100% electric. And that is called electrification.
Yes.
And so in general, when you're talking about net zero, you're meaning everything is coming from your property, or like I said, if you have a community solar. So if someone is driving up and putting a petrochemical into a tank and you're burning that, you are not net zero. And there are some electric, some PV companies that'll come up and say, you know what, your house, you don't want to get away from your oil. You don't want to get away from your propane, which I can imagine why, because propane prices are some of the most volatile ones, even when they weren't climbing.
That's true.
Incredibly volatile.
You can,
if you have high usage, you're paying less. I never understood that personally. So there are some PV companies that will come out and say, look, I'd rather sell you a system that will cover your electric loads, even though you're keeping your fossil fuel heating and whatever system that is. And that is not a net zero, right? That is where we're bringing in calories to put into your house. A calorie is just a measure of heat. And we want to do that completely on site if we're calling that a net zero house.
Exactly. And so I actually do heat with wood primarily. I do have some propane, but I also have a hybrid hot water heater, which basically derives heat from the base because my wood stove is in my basement and my hybrid electric hot water heater is also in my basement. And so for me, it was a pretty easy ask to go ahead and I could upgrade this and I could basically derive extra heat from the wood stove and bring that into the hot water heater. And so it's a great system for me, certainly. But when we're looking at this overall, if we're starting new and we're going to be building a home, how do we go about this? There are four key steps that we need to look at here.
Which are all part of looking at a house as a system. I just wanted to throw that out there. We're always hammering on that.
Exactly. And so with that, if we're trying to achieve net zero, we first want to get the design correct, okay? If we want just that big McMansion, if we want a big sprawling house in 15 different directions or this addition there and that addition there, or you've got an old-style cape with too many dormers or any dormers, you know, that's not going to be the best option for you. It's going to be much harder to achieve that if at all possible. Because with that, what you're trying to – it doesn't mean also you have to live in a shoebox either, design, because there's just so many creative designs out there that are very modern looking, very attractive, and that will be long lasting that you can consider. But it's not just the look of the house that you're trying to achieve. You want to make sure that design is going to promote the efforts of getting to net zero. The orientation of the house is really, really important because when you're on the site, especially in our climate, you want to make sure that the actual dimensions of the house are more elongated across the southern face. So that means from east to west, you're going to have more of the footprint of the building so that you have at least one of the walls there where much of the windows are going to go for solar uptake, for heating, for passive solar, that they'll be able to bring heat from the building in that direction. So getting that design right first and foremost and oriented on the lot. And I know a lot in Vermont, sometimes the less expensive lots are the ones where the sun goes down at 2 p.m, you know, because it's just you're in this holler, if you will, or in a valley. And so that makes it a little bit more difficult. So choosing that building site is really important first and foremost. But, you know, after that, when it gets to the point of, designing the home, you're also going to look for methods during the summer on how to passively cool the home, thermal flushing. So basically at night you can open up all your windows, you get a good breeze, and you can get any built-up heat out of the building. And so the next day, once you close everything back up, you're going to be able to retain that because you have a very super insulated structure that's airtight, and it'll stay so much more comfortable inside to where you don't have to use air conditioning on a normal basis. The next thing that we probably would look at, though, Chris, that we've talked about so much is after we get the design right and we get it oriented on site correctly and we get the windows applied more so on the southern side of the building.
And the right kind of windows.
And the right kind. Yes,
and passive solar shading, right?
So when
you're designing a house and you've got a lot of solar. Now, once again, passive solar design is something from the 70s where they would make the entire south face one big glazed wall. Yep. And those would overheat in the winter and they'd overheat in the summer. What we're looking for is to intelligently design our fenestration, our windows, so that they capture heat when we need heat inside the house.
Sure.
And they don't let the sun shine in when we don't want the sun in there. And we even have to look at the solar heat gain coefficient of the windows, right? High solar heat gain coefficient, like a 0.6, which is pretty high for those types of windows, means that 60% of the heat from the sun is able to get through the window into the house. If you have a standard, like an Anderson Super Low E, those are usually about 0.3. Solar heat gain coefficient. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a project recently where it was 0.19. And I, you know, said, wait a second. We want to actually capture the heat from the sun intelligently when we're heating and keep it out when we're cooling. So that orientation is important. where your windows are, the size of the windows, and that you have overhangs and other types of strategies for intelligently being able to take advantage of the sun when we want the heat inside and to not have the heat come in through the windows when we don't want it.
And as most of you know, and in case you don't, at different times of the year, the sun's at a different location in the sky. So basically, when you're going to be looking at the wintertime, you're going to be looking at a 26-degree inclination of the sun, so it's going to be lower in the sky. And that's when, if you have that fenestration or the windows on the southern side, it's going to be able to take that heat in as a positive. When it gets into the summer months and you're going to be at 74 degrees up into the sky, then you want that shading to block that extra heat from coming in so you don't super overheat the building. And there is a client of ours that we did a house like that in Colchester on Point Red Rock, and they had a situation, that very thing happened, and so we actually had proper solar shading, and then when during the summer months, you can see the sun hits their deck and only comes inside the big glazing windows a few inches. So it was perfectly designed by the architect to capture that appropriately, and it functions very, very well.
Yeah, intelligent use of overhangs and yes. other types of systems for making sure we get the sun in when we want it and we don't get the sun when we don't need it.
Exactly. And, you know, the next thing that we're going to want to do is that, you know, the airtight assembly. We've talked about this. You know, it's why it's so important, because you want to make sure you're going to reduce the heating and cooling load to make sure comfort is maximized inside the building. Thus, you're going to use less energy to heat and cool the space. And so getting that package, that envelope, if you will, on the outside properly appointed is always important, not just from a comfort standpoint, energy use standpoint, once again, a durability standpoint.
Yep, durability.
You're gonna deal with the vapor drive. You're going to deal with bulk water moisture trying to get in. And so you want to make sure you're using an assembly that isn't just some kind of membrane or building wrap that's slap stapled up there and not taped and not detailed to say it's there with the name on it, like we said before. You want to make sure it's an overall, as Chris said, assembly. You've got a rain screen on the outside, making sure you're sloughing off the moisture, but also allowing the siding to dry. You've got a proper building wrap. You've got behind that, you've got your outboard insulation, usually some inboard insulation. You've got the triple pane windows and the roof system, but everything is designed appropriately and integrated in perfectly.
So when we're talking about assemblies, once again, we want to make sure that we're hitting at least our code minimums. And code minimum right now for a wall is an R25. There are like four prescriptive paths. And I just wanted to say something about that, because Jim and I have harped on this. I happen to have had the good fortune of being on the advisory panel for the adoption of the next generation of code. And one of the things that has been said is okay in code, which I'm completely against for our climate, is we build with 2x6 and then we put 2 inches of insulation on the outside. And we've talked about the first condensing layer
or
in the
even
past.
One inch sometimes.
Yeah. What we want is we want that first condensing layer, that first solid piece of material from moving from the inside of the house to the outside, to be above the dew point during the winter when the vapor drive is from the inside to the outside. And when you build a 2x6 wall with 1 or 2 inches, you just don't have enough R value in that rigid to make sure that inside surface is not going to get beat below the dew point. For our climate, the super safe R value fluffy mix, so the percentage of the R value that's a rigid and the percentage that is fluffy, is 50-50. So instead of building with 2x6 walls and making a R23 between the studs and then R10 outside, and you can already hear that that is not a 50-50. That's like a 33%.
Or currently, 66%. Chris, it's R23 on the inside and it's R5 on the outside.
Right, which is even worse.
Exactly.
It's getting down to an R, you know, a 10% split there. Instead of demanding that we use 2x6 construction, let's go back to 2x4 construction.
Exactly.
The only reason we went to 2x6 was the idea that we needed more R value in our walls in the 1980s, and we found in the meantime that the stud losses are so big in a standard 2x6 wall with no exterior insulation that it's not a good and durable way to build, and it doesn't get you that R23. You're probably more like an R15 or 16 in that wall. Effective, what we call the effective. What's really happening. So what we want to just talking about a code house, the better code house is to build a 2x4 wall with 2 inches of rigid on the outside. Then you've got R10 on the outside, R13 between the studs. That's pretty much a 50-50 split, and that's a safe way to move forward.
Exactly. You know, because why do you want to build a brand new failed assembly?
Yeah.
You know, it may not fail today, but it will eventually fail, especially once the trees or the brush or the, you know, the bushes or the shrubbery around it starts to block more of the solar gain.
Right.
And it prevents drying, and then it can start to create some really unfortunate issues.
So solar drive is the drying that a heated surface gets when the sun hits it. So if you've got a wall and that wall gets wet through a rain event, right? The sun hits that, and as long as the sun can hit that, it will heat up that surface, and that will cause the moisture to evaporate and promote drying, right? But if you have some shrubs that you planted in front that in the very beginning were not big enough to block the sun,
sure,
but later block the sun from being able to hit the surface, that reduces the drying potential of the wall, thus increasing moisture. And we've already said, what's the one thing that we can control? That's moisture. And so we have to work really hard not to let that type of thing happen.
And if you're looking at, you know, what values are you looking to try to achieve if you're brand new construction and you are designing things, yes, code has its minimums, but somebody had said that, you know, building to code is basically getting a D on your –
striving for a D.
Yes, exactly. So if you're going to do something without having to go to the full-fledged passive requirements, passive house requirements, you'd be looking at you'd be looking at windows. You're trying to get an R value with windows of around an R5.
Minimum, yeah.
Minimum. And you're looking at for the below slab an R10. In your walls below grade, so that's in your basement areas usually, you want an R20. In your walls above grade, it'd be really great if you can get up to an R35 to an R40.
Yep.
And in your roof systems, an R80. People think an R80.
And when we're talking about R80s and roofs, we're talking about flat roofs.
Mm-hmm.
We'd love to get a slope that's R80, but usually we're topping off R60 in a slope. But in a flat, the difference between cost-wise between 1600 16 inches of cellulose and 24 is almost non-existent.
Yeah.
You know, you just throw your money there, and as long as the ceiling is well air sealed, as long as that top pressure plane is not going to let air through it, you're going to get more bang for your buck for that.
So we're basically looking now, just to review, we're looking at a proper design, a proper orientation on the site. You're looking at a really tight, well-appointed home as far as air sealing and insulation is concerned. But then we got to look at the next thing, Chris.
Yeah. The steps of producing a really good house include a good design to get your load down, but then we want to use really efficient mechanicals.
So powered by
electricity.
Exactly.
Right? Because the whole point here is if everybody is using electricity for their house, and we'll talk about the issues of the grid being able to handle that, which is definitely something that is in the mix. But if we're all using electricity, and if some of us are producing the electricity on site, the whole net zero thing, we're buying some of it off the grid. If we buy that off the grid and the grid is able to produce electricity without using coal plants, without using natural gas plants, then that electricity is also very carbon neutral as well. So we push people, or we recommend people, to try to electrify your house. As a matter of fact, the brand new Passive House standard, the Passive House Institute US, also known as FIAS, they now have a prescriptive method, but you're not allowed to have a prescriptively built house that is not all electric. So we're pushing towards what's called the decarbonization of the grid, which is reducing the number of coal plants and the number of natural gas plants. But in order to do that, you have to already be set up to have an all electric house.
Sure.
So what mechanicals are we looking at? Well, if you have that well-appointed, super-insulated, super-airtight house, then you can heat it with heat pumps, no problem.
As cold-climate heat pumps or mini-splits or something like that. Some people call them wall warts because you have this head on the wall or a cassette on the floor, or it can be a ducted system, you know, something like that. And so you're going to have the mini-split systems. That's how you heat and cool, definitely. But then you're also going to look at how are you going to cook. How are you going to dry your clothes? How are you going to heat your domestic hot water? You know, and like we said, a heat pump dryer, you could use that. You could also use a heat pump water heater, and that would be very effective. And the efficiency of those, we've talked about this before, for every unit of energy that you're putting in, you're actually yielding about at least 3 to 4 units back out of output. And so that's why they're so efficient and so effective to use.
Right, and that's that. When we were at Dixon Stuff, we got the call from the gentleman – who was saying you can't have more energy in a system than is in the system. And I was explaining it depends on how you draw the system, right?
Yes.
And a heat pump is actually using the relative hot air of minus 20 degree air outside, because the refrigerant that they're boiling boils at minus 35. So it's not breaking the laws of thermodynamics and the conservation of energy. It's just how you draw your system, right? If we look at the Earth gets enough sunlight in a day to power every house and every machine and every factory for a year. Mm-hmm. In one day.
In one day.
We're just not able to capture it all.
Exactly.
So if you draw the system with the sun and the earth, we're all set. Right? There's a 1,000%, 100,000% efficiency. But we can't capture all of that. So it really depends on how you draw your box. So what we're on the electrification front for cooking now. I'm a big fan of induction oven tops.
I am now.
With convection ovens, stovetops. And Jim wasn't. When we first started working together, he was all about the propane. He was like, I can't control it right. And then I convinced him when he had
shamed
to swap it out.
He shamed me into it. But
it's a good way to get Jim to do things, shame. And now he's out there selling it too. He always does put the caveat in that I'm the one who ruined him on this particular topic. It may have been that induction stovetops 20 years ago, 15 years ago, were not that good. But at this point, you have 20 heat settings. You know, you have up to 10 with half settings in between. And as long as you have the right pots, you have to have iron or steel-based pots. You can't use glass. You can't use aluminum.
Sure.
Because the induction is actually exciting the molecules in that pan using a magnetic field. It's induction, the induction
But it's very responsive and it's very quick. It'll take 2 quarts of water will usually boil within a minute to a minute and a half.
Yep,
and that's pretty quick. And that's very efficient at the same time.
And we've already talked about ERVs and HRVs as balanced ventilation. And those
But you're going to need it.
Yeah.
Especially once you make this really tight house and there's not a lot of air exchange, probably nil, you're going to want something to make sure that indoor air quality is maintained. And, you know, an ERV and an HRV, as we said before, is a very efficient way of making sure that happens.
Up to 95% efficient, what's called the sensible efficiency on the core. But those are all electric, right?
Yep.
You cannot get an ERV that doesn't run on electricity. Induction cooking, heat pumps, clothes dryer is an interesting one. So heat pump clothes dryer uses the heat pump technology to dry your clothes. What doesn't it do? It doesn't blow any air outside of your house. It is a ductless system.
Yes.
So you are actually heating an element. That element is using a heat pump. It's drying your clothes. It's recapturing the heat. And then it's drying the clothes more with that. That's why the efficiencies are so good. They are kind of expensive. Like a brand new heat pump dryer is like $1,400.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have a hole in your wall. You're not depressurizing your house, which then sucks air through different parts of the house that we've talked about are not always desirable. So getting a heat pump, when your dryer kicks it, consider a heat pump hot water heater.
Yeah, it's
a dryer.
Not that much. It's a few hundred dollars more than what you're probably going to be paying for one of the, you know, the front loading type of dryers that match your front loading washer. So
and they're regular companies. We're talking,
exactly.
You know, Westinghouse, Whirlpool, and LG all have a heat pump dryer on available. And the other thing that we haven't talked about yet is EV charging. Right, if you're going to be adding an electric vehicle to your car, to what you own as a car. I mean, most Vermonters have more than one car because it's not – the public transportation here is not great, and it's not great because we're a very geographically challenged state, very, very big distances between where I am and where I need to be. If you're going to be charging an electric car, they recommend adding 4,000 kilowatt hours per year to your system in order to make sure that you cover your need for that.
Yep. We've been talking about net zero buildings and how to get a home to net zero, to where basically you're producing on site all the energy you need to operate that home during the course of a year. And sometimes if you're really good at it, you can produce more energy than you use and have a net positive type of a structure.
Yeah. And to that point, what are the options for making energy other than, you know, a bicycle? You know, you plug your bike in. There was a great BBC show a number of years ago where they have a test house, an all-electric test house. Mm-hmm. And they had this hall nearby where they had all of these volunteers riding bicycles to produce the electricity
sure.
that the house was using. And everything was going fine. They had like three people riding their bike, you know, keeping the – because a person can produce about 100 watts mm-hmm. on a bike. And so if you're using a 100-watt bulb, you're riding that bike the whole hour to produce enough electricity for a 100-watt bulb. So about two-thirds of the way through the day, one of the spouses starts making a chicken dinner, and she puts it in the oven. And then they had 30 people biking, and they were barely keeping up. So it was a really good indication of exactly how much energy it costs to cook something, right?
Yep.
A water heater, electric stove. And I just want to say, if you're using propane or natural gas or some other fuel, you're using the same amount of energy. It's not mm-hmm. like water has a different amount number of calories it needs to boil. You're just using a different source. So if we're going to go all electric, then that is a good metric. You know, you need 30 people biking in order to keep the stove
going.
Yeah,
but think about that. I mean, because a PlayStation usually uses around a little over 100 watts
yeah.
to work, or an Xbox or whatever your favorite gaming system is. And if you could put that, it could solve physical fitness issues in our nation if we could actually make sure you're biking to play.
Well, now that we're getting the VR stuff, maybe we
yeah.
can set something
there
up where you have to. I love that. Okay, so the standards, right? First of all, we'll start with PV. The reason we're going to start with PV, and there are two types of solar, right? There's solar hot water, which is where you have tubes up on the roof or in a field, and the sun heats the fluid in those, and those get circulated back into the house, and you use that either for hot domestic hot water
yep.
or for heating. Those were very popular, and you could spend a lot of money on those systems. And there was a point about 12 years ago, 10 years mm-hmm. ago, where the price of solar panels, PV panels, got so cheap
yes.
that it no longer made economic sense. And there were like 20 companies out there selling passive solar systems or active solar systems,
mm-hmm.
and they just dried up. Because if I can spend a similar amount of money and get PV, PV panels are going to be good up to 90% of their output after 25 years,
yeah.
still 80% of their output after 50 years. And all of these active solar hot water systems were breaking down. They had pumps.
Sure.
You had to exchange the fluid that was going on. So when we're talking solar these days, although active solar hot water was a thing, we're no longer talking about. We're just talking about photovoltaics.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of companies out there that provide site assessments and all of that for solar panels, and you should definitely take a look at those if you're interested. But once again, just want to say it, make sure you get your house appointed properly before you look at doing a net zero energy photovoltaic system.
Yeah, you know, button it up, get it insulated, you know, keep the warm air inside during the winter and the cool air during the summer, and don't let it escape. And then look at going towards the renewables. And with the renewables, you know, the neat thing about the solar, as Chris said, sure, it's an 80% efficiency near 50 years, the 50-year mark, but then you could just not take the whole system out. You can add a few panels to augment the needs of the home, and you're going to be right back where you were before.
And so another option, and the only place I've ever seen this actually work is out on the islands, the North Hero, South Hero, Grand
sure.
Island, is wind. Wind is a great option if you have them in the right place, right? And small wind, I'm not talking about, megawatt towers. I'm talking about like a 5 kilowatt system in your own yard, on your own tower, is an option, but you have to make sure you're putting it in a place where it actually makes sense. There's even a gas station restaurant on Route 7 coming into Burlington mm-hmm. that a number of years ago put a wind turbine on top, and it never ran, and it's falling. It's still there. It's falling apart, which is a bit of a shame because it was a pretty cool technology, that particular type of wind turbine. So wind is an option, but it's very site specific, right?
Yep.
You have to make sure that you've got enough wind to make that work worthwhile. It's a, $20,000 investment
sure.
and, moving parts. Once again, one thing I love about PV, no moving parts.
Yep.
You know, after 40 years, nothing's going to break because the bushing didn't work or the bearing failed.
The blade broke.
Right. But you're going to have that with wind. Wind is a great technology, but it does have its downsides.
But then you can also look at one that's not often looked looked at, but there's probably very few people in Vermont that have something like this, but it's a hydroelectric. You know, granted, we have those in the dams that we have around in the various rivers and streams, but you could also do that on site if you do have a smaller stream that is, you know, it's aggressive, but, yep. You know, if you can set it up right, you could do some power generation. Some of the shortcomings, though, of renewables in the past, and it's still possible now, is that if you can produce more energy than you need at the wrong times and have no way to capture it or utilize it. So I've seen there's four windmills on a mountain near where I live. I won't specifically say where that is.
Because he doesn't want to dox himself.
Yeah, but with that, at times those are completely shut down even on windy days because the demand isn't there. So battery storage is what's going to become very, very important, not just for municipalities, but also for on-site. So if you have a very effective way to have battery storage, so you, when you do generate the power, you're not just – if you don't net meter, which means you're sending back the site-generated energy that you don't need in the peak times back to the power company for credit, you're going to want to have a way to store that. And so the battery storage, like a Tesla wall or something like that, is becoming more and more important.
And when I had the solar system installed just this past month at my house and finally went net zero, we are net metering, which means that every kilowatt hour that I produce, I get paid the same amount of money that I, you know, Green Mountain Power would be paid for that same kilowatt hour. But I also wanted to make sure that when power goes out, that I'm going to be able to coast for a day or so. So here's the funny switch, right? I'm an all-electric house. In the winter, when I'm producing the least and using the most, my 20 kilowatt hours of battery backup is only going to keep me in heat and ventilation and refrigerator for a day.
Yeah.
The same system is going to keep my house going for a week during the summer when I'm not using my heat pumps. Mm-hmm. So, and it's not an inexpensive system. You know, 20 kilowatt hours of backup battery is like $15,000. And what's the return on investment on that? Well, the return on investment is my knowing that I have the power, right?
Yeah, definitely.
When I need it.
And what's going to have to change, though, and it is changing on, you know, seems like on a daily basis, is battery technology is improving.
Yep.
Where a lithium dielectric, which is used primarily, which is toxic and it has a lot of issues with it, and the lithium mines are one of the most toxic in the world of all mining that is done, they're going to different dielectric, like a solid state type of a battery setup, and other types of items that are going to be used. And if they can get to that, they're going to be much lighter.
Yep.
They're going to have a longer life cycle, and we're not going to have some recycling issues down the road.
There are two technologies that are developing in the battery world, which I've been following for quite a while, which are really exciting. One of them is an iron battery, where they actually add ions to an iron matrix, and that's able to store the battery, the electricity until you need it. And the other one is using carbon fiber, very nanotechnologies, right? So if we get to things that are very small, then the physics change when we get that small. And we might be able to create batteries that are just these soups of these small holes that hold on to electrons, basically, create the potential difference, which is what a battery is, and then drain it off as we're needing it.
Okay, so with that, you know, we've been talking about these items, which are very true for new construction. And they're very still similar with retrofit situations. So, but with that, when you start in a retrofit situation, you're trying to get to net zero. In fact, I was just watching a show that was about an 1800s home that they were bringing to net zero. And you think, is that even possible? Well, it's a deep energy retrofit to get there, but it is still possible. You first start out, though, with the first step needs to be the proper design. And in this case, probably the proper energy modeling. You want to find out what is the house currently using and what do you need to get there to meet those needs. Is that enough to do just a regular energy retrofit or weatherization job and then add enough PV or other, you know, power generation things on site along with improved mechanicals to get to where you want to be? Or do you have to go deep energy retrofit where you're putting usually on a deep energy retrofit on an existing home, you are taking the siding off. You are changing out windows. You're bringing some of that insulation, the right proportion ratio to the outside of the building and making sure the cavity insulation is going to be adequate. So you have a very solid assembly, and you're making sure, once again, all the boxes are checked, the fact that you're going to make a very durable structure. You're going to make it weather tight. You're going to make sure that the vapor drive is considered appropriately. Yep. So you're not going to, you know, tighten up the home, but then starting a mold factory. And then on the other side, you're also going to want to make sure once you tighten up a home that much, you're going to test for existing radon. You're going to also check for indoor air quality, and you probably want to get more than just a regular high efficiency bath fan in there. What you're going to want to look at is one of those ERVs or HRVs once again.
So when we're talking about retrofits, just keep in mind that a deep energy retrofit is going to start at about $100,000.
Yep.
This is not an inexpensive thing. And if your house is worth $300,000, that's a quarter, you know, a third of the value of the house right there.
Sure.
It's not something that I would recommend people doing on their own unless they're builders themselves, because there's a lot of things going on in there. And if you're going to be adding exterior insulation, that means you need to extend your window box. I mean, all kinds of things that are complicated, not impossible to learn, but complicated.
But if you're going to end up needing to replace your siding and your windows anyway, or your roof, this is when you take an opportunity to address these issues at that time to make the cost less, to diminish the cost.
And not have to do them later on. I mean, if you're going to be pulling the siding off the house because of a durability issue, then you should go ahead and go and look at what's the little bit more I'm going to have to go. I'm already incurring this expense. What's that going to be?
Well, you know, the one thing that can help pay for this as well is that, you know, if we're looking at how we're going to fund certain programs throughout the nation, increased subsidies would certainly help if we were, as a nation, trying to get there. That could be one great way to invest, not just spend money, but to invest money in our infrastructure in that area. But right now, there are current programs through Efficiency Vermont for new builds and weatherization retrofits that consumers can take advantage of, provided that they have that proper site assessment done and energy assessment or home performance assessment done. You can then tap into those rebates and help offset some of these costs. But when you look at solar, if you're trying to get the PV array up there, there are still 26% federal tax credits available to offset that cost. And when you couple that 26% discount tax rebate on there, with the PV array, you usually are going to be experiencing a payback on that for a system that's going to be very effective to the 50-year mark in about 15 years. It could be a little bit less, but usually 15 years is a sweet spot where your investment is paid for and then your power is free.
Yeah, and if you're interested in learning more about that solar array thing, Jim and I had an interview with Paul Lesueur, who's the owner of Green Mountain Solar.
Yeah, great company.
Great company. That's who I use. They happen to be members of the Home Builders. Just throw a shout out to the Home Builders of Vermont. And so that is on our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/c/housecallsvermont. Just go to the interview section, and the interview is right there. Lots of good information about a lot of the questions that we've been answering today. Another source, though, if you are able to put a PV array up that covers your entire annual usage for the house, there's a program in Vermont called ZEN, Zero Energy Now. Mm-hmm. And if you look up Zero Energy Now Vermont on a Google search, you'll get their website. There's about another $2,000 or $3,000 available for people who are electrifying their houses and going net zero. And so this program is on top of any incentives that Efficiency Vermont is doing, because the Efficiency Vermont incentives, or the Vermont gas incentives, which are basically parallel, those are based on the reduction of load and reduction of air leakage and things like that. It's not based on adding PV, and the Zero Energy Now is specifically about the Zero Energy Now and getting to a zero energy house.
Sure. And, you know, we're coming up on the end of our show for this week, but you know, some of the topics that we're going to be talking about in the weeks to come. Next week, which is a Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Yay. Turkey Day.
Yeah.
Hey, if you're out there and you're already, like, celebrating Christmas, I'm hurt. I'm just personally hurt. I've been in a lot of stores. They didn't even go to Thanksgiving. They went right to Christmas. And I'm like, okay, I understand that we've had a couple of years of COVID and the companies really need to make the money, and they make more money on Christmas than Thanksgiving. But let's just pace ourselves here, people.
Well, you know, and it's not an emotional eating competition on Thursday that coming up, but you still may want to go ahead and enjoy family, friends, invite a neighbor over, you know, so have that opportunity to engage one another. another, and be thankful. Once again, be thankful for what we have. Be thankful that we're still here and we have opportunities. But one of the opportunities we're going to explore next week on the show is going to be about the indoor air quality and the launching of our study that we're going to be doing. So we're going to be getting more of those out there, culling some of the results we've already obtained, and be able to share those with you, but launching it next week and going back over the indoor air quality importance for anybody living in a building, quite honestly. And so that's going to be part of the discussion. In the future, we're going to also be talking about a pretty good house. You know, how do you basically, you know, you don't, may not go to the passive house standard or the net zero standard, but then what really would be the most cost effective for you to get into and then maybe in the future go to that next level? And we were talking about something earlier too, another topic that you wanted to bring to the table earlier that we wanted to discuss in the coming weeks.
I'm drawing a blank.
Okay, it's going to be about Ginkgo biloba, whatever the memory.
Ginkgo biloba.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you have questions in the meantime, you certainly can send out an email inquiry to our website or to our email address,
housecallsvt@gmail.com,
and you can go to our website and view the interview that we had
YouTube
with Paul
Lesher,
YouTube channel, and view that because it's really interesting about PV arrays or solar arrays and get a little bit better educated.
Yep. So this is until next week after Gobble Gobble Day, and then we can start with our Christmas preparations. Chris West, have a good holiday, and until next time.
And Jim Bradley as well. Have a great week.
House Calls Vermont has been brought to you by R.K. Miles, a third-generation family-owned business, proud to be your local building materials supplier. Find a location near you at rkmiles.com. By Poly Construction, for over 30 years known for anything construction, big or small jobs, one call does it all. POLLIConstruction.com. Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor, 802-793-2002. Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. And Ken Libby of the Stowe Area Realty Group at Keller Williams Stowe, your trusted advisor, 802-793-2002. By Curtis Lumber, with two locations in Vermont, Williston and Burlington. Request a quote for your next project online at curtislumber.com. Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, with locations in St. Albans, Enosburg, Swanton, Derby, and Middlesex. Shamrock Painting, painting and custom wood finishing, shamrockpainting.com. Matt Clark's Northern Basement Systems, for all things basementy, northernnefoundations.com. Be sure to join us again next Saturday at 12:30 during the noon hour for House Calls Vermont. These are the stations of Radio Vermont.